wonderful to be here. I would like to address three issues tonight. The first being the relationship of K to the masters. I want to first document the fact that there was a very intimate relationship between K and the masters. I'm speaking of Krishnamurti as K because that would make it easier. Otherwise, we would be saying polysyllabics all night long. Then I would like to address some issues that have been quite confusing regarding Krishnamurti. Any of you who are acquainted with Krishnamurti's life, his teaching, or the history of the Theosophical Society, or preferably all of the above, know for a fact that there are still quite a number of issues that are confusing to many in a number of ways. And then I would like to address issues having to do with the eminent relevance to the history of the Theosophical Society to all this whole subject of the relationship between Krishnamurti and the masters. I will speak of the Theosophical Society. Many of you have heard as the TS, also for similar reasons. Okay, the first thing I guess one can say about the relationship between Krishnamurti and the masters was his so-called discovery on Adyar Beach at the headquarters of the Theosophical Society in Madras, India, in the year 1909 by C.W. Leadbeater. Many of you, I'm sure, are well acquainted with who C.W. Leadbeater was. I like to refer to him as C.W.L. Krishnamurti happened to be on the headquarters for various reasons that are explained in books about his life. And C.W.L. happened to be walking down the beach one day and saw this impressive boy or young man. He was 13 at the time and was quite impressed with his aura. Now, C.W.L. was a very great clairvoyant. In fact, one of the things that I document to some extent in this book is the fact that practically everything that has been said about auras or kundalini or chakras or vibrations, thought forms, practically the whole field of psychic energies, the whole nomenclature of that whole field and the conceptual structure and the literary structure of that whole field was created, I say, almost single-handedly by C.W.L. A lot of what he was saying, of course, was based on what H.P. Blavatsky had taught before him. But C.W.L. created a whole new language to speak about all these things, and most people are not aware of how profound his influence has been. So anyone, I don't care who it is, even people in very ancient traditions, such as the Tibetan tradition, or the Hindu tradition, or the Buddhist tradition, who have been speaking in the 20th century about many of these issues, have taken over the conceptual way in which Leadbeater spoke about these matters. They have used his language, and in some cases, and I have books to show this, in some cases they have even borrowed his pictures and his depictions of the aura or thought forms and so forth. And so Leadbeater was a formidable person in his own right, given the work he did clairvoyantly. I am not aware of, I don't know everything, but I am not aware of anyone else in the whole history of mankind, really, who has had such an impact from a clairvoyant point of view. Before C.W.L., there had been many clairvoyants, but they either spoke from the perspective and using the language of particular cultures, particular regions of the world, Or they would use language that was very technical, extremely technical, and I go into that in the book. And so when you hear, for instance, the Beach Boys singing about good vibrations, the word vibrations was brought into the English language by C.W. Leadbeater. So I mentioned that so that you see to what extent that influence has been so pervasive. This was no small clairvoyant he. And so when C.W.L. saw Krishnamurti's aura, he was tremendously impressed with it. He said he had never seen such a selfless aura in his life. And he was so impressed, he wanted to meet the boy, and so he did. That led to C.W.L. realizing that this was a very special individual. And he proceeded to make investigations into Krishnamurti's previous incarnations. And eventually, a book was published of these researches called, I think it's called The Last 50 Lives of Alcyone. It's Alcyone, not with a K, but with a C. It's a hard C. And The Last 50 Lives of Krishnamurti, who is given the pen name, we could say, of Alcyone in Leadbeater's work, he gives us an outline of each of those past 50 lives, and he saw what a special individual this was. Eventually, those researches and Leadbeater's contact with the masters who are said to have been behind the foundation of the Theosophical Society, he was told by these masters that this boy would be used as the vehicle for an avatar manifestation that would come in the 20th century. Leadbeater was also told that, according to him, and then Mrs. Annie Besant, who was the president of the Theosophical Society at that time, they both said that H.P. Blavatsky, before she died, and the masters directly, had said to them individually that the main purpose of the Theosophical Society was to be the herald of this avataric manifestation, this tremendous thing that was going to happen in the 20th century. The expression New Age that we hear so everywhere, in sitcoms, advertising, commercials, everywhere. H.P. Blavatsky, or H.P.B., was the first person to speak about that. And what she was talking about was that there would be a tremendous meeting of grand cycles at this time in history, and humanity would undergo tremendous changes during this period. And when such great changes happen, there is an avatar manifestation. It's a teaching that you see in some of the existing traditions, such as the Tibetan tradition and others. And so when C.W.L. and Besant began to make these declarations, the fact is that no one else really in the Theosophical Society had ever heard of such a thing. They did not know of any such thing in any of HPB's writings. And so where did they get this stuff? Where did they get such claims, such bombastic claims about the place in history of the Theosophical Society? And so they were often challenged when they were speaking in public, or people would write to them, or they would have violent arguments with them in public. Their lives were very, very difficult as a result of this. They risked a great deal by making such declarations. They both said, Leadbeater especially, said that at the time that he would have rather not done any of that. The only reason why he made the declarations was the master had told him, you have to do this, and like a good soldier, he just did it. And he didn't think it was a good idea at all to make all of this public. And so all of that publicity was extremely painful to both of them personally, and it also hurt the work of the Theosophical Society as they understood it and as many others understood it at the time. And so this was a tremendously terrible thing, a terrible time in a certain sense in the history of the Theosophical Society. Many, many members quit the society. A number of New Age organizations, as we call them today, were created as the result of that split over that whole issue, or different aspects of that issue. And so it was quite a big, big thing. And the members who remained, quote-unquote, loyal, even though they didn't have any evidence either. And so very often, as I said, both Besant and Leadbeater would be challenged by various people. And there are records of some of the quotations that they used from H.P. Blavatsky at the time the letters from the masters were not available. Those letters only became available in 1921, not all of them. And so the only thing they had to go on was the writings of H.P. Blavatsky. Besant used, for instance, on one occasion, Blavatsky's reference in The Key to Theosophy to a great teacher who would come 100 years later in 1975. And, of course, that was not it. And so people criticize her for that. And so the fact that neither CWL nor Besant ever gave references in writing from HPB and the masters, and of course, as I say, the masters were not a factor there, but then in the 1920s they didn't either, indicates to me that they themselves were not aware that there was any such reference. And so the relationship between Krishnamurti and the masters has profound implications for the history of the Theosophical Society, what it means, what it is or what it isn't, and as well as for practically every single organization, group, book, or idea that we call New Age or whatever you want to call it. In my book, I use a different expression. I refer to that grand phenomenon which did take place, just as Blavatsky said. What happened in the 20th century has been something truly tremendous in the science, in psychology, in education, in the arts. For instance, all the art of the 20th century hails back to the non-objective art of the beginning of the century. Well, all the members of that group, Picasso, Piet Mondrian, Paul Klee, Marc Chagall, Vasily Kandinsky, all of them were either members of the Theosophical Society or were deeply, deeply influenced by Blavatsky's work. And what they were doing was trying to represent in an artistic way what they had learned from Blavatsky by means of words and concepts. And so, and these are just, I give many, a few more references in the book about such influences. And so I am saying that understanding what that movement, which has been so influential in the creation of the 20th century as we know it, the culture of the whole planet as we know it, this is of great importance, I think, for the whole planet, one way or another. If, of course, CWL and Besant were mistaken about this or were hallucinated, as some people said, others accused them of deceiving, of outright lying about all this. Lord knows why, because, as I said, it was very, very painful to them and a great source of trouble. So anyway, all of these issues are involved in this topic that we're talking about tonight. It's a loaded, loaded, loaded topic. Very soon after CWL discovered Krishnamurti. As I say, this notion that this might be the vehicle, not the avatar himself, but a vehicle for the avatar, began to be made public. And Krishnamurti began to be prepared for his first initiation, his first grand transformation in his work for the masters and in his work for his mission. And the first initiation took place in 1910. And over a period of a few months, he had to prepare. He would see the master every night in the inner planes, and the master would give him some instructions as to things that he needed to do in his life so that he would be prepared for that grand transformation, and he would begin to undergo that grand transformation, which an initiation always is. And every morning when he woke up, this boy, who was barely aware of the English language at that time, he was just learning. They were teaching, tutoring him in English in the compound of the headquarters of the Theosophical Society. He was, with great difficulty, remembering what the master had told him during the night. And he would write it down, all these various instructions, so that he could look at them again in his conscious mind, using the brain consciously, because that's a critical component of initiations, that things that you experience in the inner planes have to happen in at the conscious level. The brain has to engage in it. And there were a number of witnesses who saw Krishnamurti do this. And I say that because in such an atmosphere as I have just described, there were many who accused CWL of being the author of the book. And that there is no evidence for that at all. And in fact, as I say, there is pretty convincing evidence, let's put it that way. I mean, all the witnesses that saw Krishnamurti writing in the morning and struggling to try to think of what were the English words that he needed to use to do this. And so the result of that was that all these notes that Krishnamurti took, eventually, when the initiation process was completed, the master said to CWL, "I'd like to see that manuscript. This might be worth looking at." Presumably, the master then took it to the Lord Maitreya. The Lord Maitreya is the name of the avataric manifestation that was said to be about to give the keynote teaching for the new era, for the new age. And according to that account, it was the Lord Maitreya who said, "This little book needs to be published." And so that is how a little book called At the Feet of the Master came to be published. You believe what you want to about that, but it is unquestionably an extremely powerful little book. It's a small book and written in a very simple way, very simple language, but boy, is it powerful. And so one thing to consider about what the source of that book may have been is to just look at the facts of, here is this young boy who had no education at that point. He had no exposure, really, to any kind of culture in any way. He hardly knew English. And yet this tremendous book comes out. And so it's something that one needs to take into account, all these factors, because so many things have been said about that book. So anyway, in that little book, the first sentence of the book, the first sentence of the first published book that Krishnamurti ever published, says, and I quote, These are not my words. They are the words of the master who taught me. And as I will show to you tonight, that sentence could be used for everything that Krishnamurti taught until he died. And you will see, because I have a quote from 10 days before he died where he says precisely that. And so it is important to look at the fact that there is documentation, insofar as one can document something like this, to the effect that there was such an intimate relationship between Krishnamurti and the masters throughout his life. And I would like to give you now a kind of a point-by-point of at different stages in his life how he continued to have that kind of relationship, that kind of very intimate relationship. In 1922, Krishnamurti experienced, perhaps I should back up a moment, he was initiated in 1910. In 1911, Mrs. Besant took Krishnamurti to England for a number of reasons that we don't need to go into now, and he ended up, because the World War took place not too long after that, the world was in turmoil, and Mrs. Besant was interested, and CWL also, but Mrs. Besant mainly took charge of Krishnamurti. She became really his tutor, the person that he looked to as his mother, and he called her Amma, which in his language means mama. And so they had that kind of a relationship. And so she took him to England to be educated. And as it happened, when she returned to India, she never saw him until 1921. So that was an absence of 10 years. The war and then other complications made it impossible. And Krishnamurti didn't see CWL again either until 1921 as well. And so for 10 years, they didn't have any relationship. So Krishnamurti spent his youth surrounded basically by rich Victorians. The society at the time was very fortunate. Mrs. Besant especially befriended a number of people in England mainly, but also in other parts of the world, who happened to have a lot of money that they wanted to contribute to many of Mrs. Besant's causes. She was an active lady, and she was involved in so many causes for social reform, defending women, defending children, anybody who needed defending, she was there. And so all these causes required money, and she got the money from all these rich people. So Krishnamurti ended up being surrounded by all these people, and he continued having a correspondence with Besant and CWL, but it wasn't the same. And so, as it was, Krishnamurti lived out most of his youth doing the sorts of things that you would expect a very wealthy young kid doing in such an environment. He was playing golf, and he was supposed to be very good too at it. He loved cars, and so and had great mechanical abilities, and so he loved to race cars and do things that young people do. Nothing here about any vehicle manifestation or spiritual anything, you know, so far as we can tell. And so in 1921, the party was over. It was time to deliver the goods, so to say. Krishnamurti himself saw that it was time for him to, quote-unquote, get serious. And he set out to try to be better, to be a good boy, in a way. And I'm not being flippant about these. These are expressions that he himself and others used at the time. So in 1922, Krishnamurti arrived for the first time in the Ojai Valley in California. Ojai Valley is about 90 miles north of Los Angeles. And at the time, Mr. A.P. Warrington, who was president of this section, he had the post of that John Algio has today, had a house in Ojai and invited Krishnamurti and his brother to go there. And they arrived, and soon after, Krishnamurti began to do a very simple form of meditation. About 15 minutes every day, he would think of the Lord Maitreya. He was trying to, as he put it, get his touch back with the masters. And his way of doing it was to do these meditations, trying to raise his awareness, raise his consciousness to higher levels of awareness where the Bodhisattva, the Lord Maitreya, reigned supreme, so to say. He wanted to be in touch with that and see what that was like. 15 minutes a day doing this. Well, what do you know? In less than 2 weeks, he began to have some astonishing experiences. He began to feel tremendous pain up his spine and into his head, and at one point developed a big lump on the back of the neck, big thing, about the size of an orange. And so there was great consternation and concern about that. So he asked CWL, what's going on here? What's this? I don't know what, you know, I was just sitting there, you know, 15 minutes a day, you know, I mean, talk about instant, I wouldn't call it enlightenment, but instant something, you know. I mean, that was quite an impressive thing to undergo. And he didn't know what was going on. And when CWL later studied the case, remember, we're talking about someone who, at least in my perception, is the greatest clairvoyant of all times. The greatest clairvoyant of all times publicly known. There must be masters who are far more, far greater that way than Leadbeater ever could have been back then. But so far as we know publicly, no one has had his abilities and has had such an influence. Leadbeater didn't know what was happening. He knew that it was an initiatory procedure, an initiatory process, but he could not understand why there should be such pain, why there should be such a strange development. Never heard of any such thing in any literature, anywhere, in any source he knew, and by looking at Krishnamurti, he could not tell what the source of that was. And so that was a great mystery. He did say all along that that was an initiatory experience. In my book, I give a suggestion as to what might be an explanation for what happened, why it was that CWL could not understand what was happening, and also, you know, why CWL could not really understand what was happening to K. My suggestion is the following. In the esoteric instructions of H.P. Blavatsky, which are said to have been written by her teachers, by the masters, there are a couple of passages in which the masters speak of the chakras, the real psychic centers, as being not located up the human spine, as we normally think. What they say is that that is an exoteric teaching that many, that the tantric schools and other schools have simply accepted. The real chakras, the master says, are all seven of them in the head. And in the rest of the body, there are 42 plexuses, as he calls them. And what we call the seven chakras are part of that system of plexus in the body. Now, in that passage, what the masters say is that more information would be given later about that teaching on the chakras. But nothing was ever given again unless it was given in a secret way to someone that we don't know about. And so the only application that I am aware of for that teaching in the esoteric instructions, which were later published in the third edition of the Secret Doctrine as part of the third volume, the so-called controversial third volume. In that passage, the masters are speaking of the chakras as being something completely different. The only place, the only application that I am aware of for that teaching is Krishnamurti's experience. Every time that Krishnamurti spoke about what was happening to him, he referred to the head. He never referred, he did say the spine was burning. The spine was burning, but he didn't speak about chakras in the spine. He spoke about chakras in the head all the time. And so that's an interesting factor. Anyway, what was happening to him, Kay called the process. And that name stuck, and everybody has referred to the process ever since. And so throughout the 1920s, he continued experiencing the process. And apparently throughout the 1930s, as I document in the book, in 1948, he was in India, and Pupul Jayakar, who wrote a book called Krishnamurti, a biography, a very interesting book, except the first part. The first part of the book is full of mistakes and misstatements about the Theosophical Society and about what the teachings of Theosophy are. But apart from that, it really is an exquisite book in the sense that it gives a sense of what it was like to be with Krishnamurti and discuss things with him and so forth over a period of many, many years. So Pupul Jayakar and her sister Nandini had just met Krishnamurti, and he had experiences of the process at the time. And again, he referred to the masters as he had when he first experienced the process. He said all along that the masters were conducting an experiment that had never been tried in the history of mankind. It was something new. In 1961 and 62, Krishnamurti was writing a journal about his inner life, and that was later published in 1976 under the title Krishnamurti's Notebook. And in that notebook, he also refers to the existence of the process, how this was still going on, and how it was connected with those higher states of awareness that were identified in his earlier writings with the masters in one way or another. Then in 1975, Mary Lothians wrote a book called The Years of Awakening. This was meant to be a biography of Krishnamurti. And for the first time in that book was revealed that Krishnamurti had this very rich inner life, this contact with the masters, chakras, kundalini, all kinds of strange experiences. Strange, that is, to the very many people who had been listening to Krishnamurti, because if you know anything about what Krishnamurti had been teaching, it is very, very different from all this talk that we have been doing tonight so far. There is no reference to masters in Krishnamurti's teaching. There is no reference to following anyone. There is no reference to a spiritual path that you follow. And so what he was doing was radically different. And so people who read the book didn't know what to make of it. What do you mean they said that you were going to be the world teacher? What does that mean? Where is that? What are we going to do with that? What does that have to do with what you have been telling us all this time? What's going on here? This certainly must be that these theosophies, these theosophy people must be crazy, must be nuts. And that's the reason why they believed all that stuff. They were flakes of some sort. That's totally absurd, talking about ascended masters or whatever they thought. Well, they asked Krishnamurti a question about that. And I would like to read to you a quote that I have in the book. This quote appears in the book Truth and Actuality, Truth and Actuality was published in 1978, but this conversation took place, this dialogue took place in 1976, shortly after the book was published. These Krishnamurtiites were concerned citizens. They wanted to know, well, what's going on here? You know, you tell us. Well, what this business of masters and chakras, kundalini, not to mention the Lord Maitreya, God forbid. Okay, so they ask him the question. And Krishnamurti says the following. One of the questions is about the masters, as they are explained not only in theosophy, but in the Hindu tradition and in the Tibetan tradition, which maintain that there is a bodhisattva and that he manifests himself rarely, and that is called in Sanskrit avatar, which means manifestation. This boy was discovered and prepared for that manifestation. He's saying this boy was discovered and prepared for that manifestation. That's what he's saying. And he went through all kinds of things. And one question that may be asked is, must others go through the same process? Christopher Columbus discovered America with sailing boats in dangerous seas and so on. And must we go through all that to go to America? You understand my question? It is much simpler to go by air. I'll say something about all this in a moment. That is one question. How the boy was brought up is totally irrelevant. What is relevant is the present teaching and nothing else. Now, you will notice they are asking him, what about all these initiations? What about these masters? What about this bodhisattva? He does not say that would have been a wonderful opportunity for Krishnamurti to have said, rubbish, that's nonsense, forget about all that, which he often did in other contexts about things that he thought were totally mistaken. He did not such thing. He confirmed the whole thing. What he said is, all of that happened, all of that is true, but it's irrelevant. Why was he saying that it's irrelevant? My take on that is that what really matters is that there be transformation in our personal lives. And it's very easy to get distracted away from that. Very easy to get distracted. You can read books about the masters. You can listen to lectures about the masters. Talk about it like we're doing here tonight. And that has a value. It has a place. But that does not bring transformation in our lives, does it? And so that's what he was talking about. And the thing that Krishnamurti felt was critical was that there be that transformation. He was adamant about that, radical about that, and had absolutely no compromises, wouldn't make no compromises on that subject. And so that was the way in which he presented that. He further says in that passage, there is a very ancient tradition about the bodhisattva. See, the word bodhisattva was used, Buddhists used the word in a different sense, but theosophists were using the word bodhisattva to refer to that grand avataric manifestation. So when they said the bodhisattva, that's what they meant. They meant exclusively that avatar. In Buddhism, it is used in a more generic sense. There is a very ancient tradition about the bodhisattva that there is a state of consciousness, let me put it that way, which is the essence of compassion. If what mattered to him was that that is not a person called Maitreya, called Christ, whatever name you want to give to it. The essence of compassion is not a person. It's a state of awareness that you either share in or you don't. And so that's how he characterizes it. And so when the world is in chaos, that essence of compassion manifests itself. That is the whole idea behind the avatar and the bodhisattva. And there are various gradations, initiations, various masters, and so on. And also, there is the idea that when he manifests, all the others keep quiet. You understand? And that essence of compassion has manifested at other times. In other words, this is a cyclical moment in humanity, in the history of humanity. And so here we have the mature Krishnamurti in 1976 confirming the fact that he had had all these initiations. He had had this very intimate relationship with the masters, and that he was the vehicle for the avataric manifestation. That is astonishing to anyone acquainted with Krishnamurti's work, because it seems to be profoundly incompatible with what he was teaching. I personally do not see a incompatibility whatsoever, and that is one of the grand themes of the book. And so in doing this, Krishnamurti was confirming the presence of the masters in T.S. history, wasn't he? Because the masters that he was talking about were introduced to him by C.W. Leadbeater. And so if Krishnamurti was having that intimate relationship with the masters, it means that Leadbeater was having an intimate relationship with the masters. And if Leadbeater was having that intimate relationship with the masters, he was introduced to them by H.P. Blavatsky. And so, to me, the evidence provided by Krishnamurti, given who he was as a teacher, what a serious teacher he was, and that he did not want to sensationalize any of this. He never spoke about this in public. This was not like some guru from India coming here to tell us, I am the world teacher, you know, wearing a turban or something, you know. He was not interested in any of that. And even here, when he's giving his response, you may notice that his response, even though he's acknowledging astonishing things about himself, he's doing it in such a low-key, matter-of-fact way. Yes, this is a fact, and that is a fact, and that is a fact. Next question. And so he had no interest in promoting any of that. And so that fact, I think, lends enormous credibility to my mind. Knowing what I know about Krishnamurti, that this is something that needs to be taken seriously. I personally see it as the most important evidence that I'm aware of for the real existence of the masters in the history of the Theosophical movement. For instance, shortly after the biography came out, another thing that happened was Mary Zimbalist, who was one of his close associates until he died, she was puzzled about all that because she had never heard about all this. She knew about the theosophists who had these crazy ideas about masters and all, but she didn't know, which means that people close to him never heard of any of this stuff. He was not promoting any of this. To me, that's a very important thing to keep in mind about this. She asked him, well, if the masters were teaching back then, if the masters were there at the time when CWL was around, if the masters were giving a teaching, how come we don't see them anymore? You know what Krishnamurti responded? I mean, he could have said to her, this is a close associate. He could have said, oh, again, that's rubbish. Forget about that. No masters. He said, the reason why the masters are no longer teaching is, he said, there is no need now that the Lord is here. This is what he said. These are not my words. This is what he said. And so I find all of this profoundly poignant. Now, I'd like to say a few things about why there has been so much confusion about all this. One thing is that in his work, as I mentioned before, Kay emphasized the fact that what really matters is that there be transformation in our lives. And the fact is, unfortunately, that most people prefer being distracted. And they could choose to be distracted by talking about masters, by talking about how you get to meet the master, how what the master looked like, what color was his beard, and so forth and so on. How tall was the master? His eyes looked special. All of this has nothing to do with transformation, nothing. And so Krishnamurti was profoundly impatient with anybody who came to him to talk about that stuff. He did not want to talk about that. And so whenever anyone came to him to talk about things like that, he would just put them away. He said, that's silly. There are no such masters. Of course there are no such masters. The masters that he was denying were the masters of fantasy, the masters of illusion that people create. They want to be special themselves. They want to know that they are in touch with some great entity. And so we all create a lot of fantasies. Now, I want to say something here. Throughout the many organizations that splintered off from the Theosophical Society and those that splintered off from those and so on and so on, there's a long history of that. Many of these organizations, their leaders and others, speak about how KH, one of the masters who established the Theosophical Society, wrote this book that I am publishing now, or I am in contact with this or that master, and so forth. Now, personally, I think that in some of that, not all of it, in some of that literature, one finds a number of things of value, and that is good. Wherever you see a gem, by all means, take it and do something good with it. But it is a fact that in none of these organizations, none of these books, none of these other authors and promoters and even telemarketers now, it's come to that, is there any evidence, physical or psychological or spiritual, that there were any such masters connected with this. In the case of the history of the society, there is quite a bit of very solid evidence for the physical presence of the masters. And if you're interested in this, the place to go, in my opinion, is the 6 volumes, count them, big things like that, each one of them, called Old Diary Leaves by Colonel Henry Steele Olcott, who was the first president of the Theosophical Society. Olcott was a lawyer, had been a psychic researcher, an extremely serious investigator. In fact, he was so highly regarded during the Civil War that he was put in charge of the Lincoln assassination because there was a great deal of suspicion at the time, you know, North versus South, and people didn't know who could have killed Lincoln, and they needed to have in charge of the investigation someone that everyone respected in the North and in the South alike, and that person was Colonel Henry Steele Olcott. Very, very serious person, and a very serious investigator into psychic fraud. He was a specialist in that subject. And so Olcott had many experiences in which he met the masters physically, and in many of those experiences, there would be other people present as well. Every single time, Olcott would draw up an affidavit, and he would give a description of what happened, how the master came into that experience, and then he would have the witnesses sign it, and he would have the thing notarized, and there are a whole bunch of these affidavits. And so the kind of evidence that he had is, I guess, good in a court of law even, if you want to go that far. And so it's very, very solid evidence. There is no such evidence anywhere else. And then, of course, you have the evidence given by Krishnamurti, which is evidence of a totally different sort. Psychological, spiritual. If you see what this man was saying in his work, you see that something very, very special was going on in here. And this man, who had no interest in sensationalizing any of this, is telling you it was not me who was giving this teaching. It was this deeper consciousness. I want to pick my final quote about this from 10 days before Krishnamurti died. I said before I was going to refer to that. On the 7th of February of 1986, he was in his deathbed. And here's what happened. On February 7, 10 days before he died, he stated again, unambiguously, that his body was but an instrument, just as CWL and AB, Annie Besant, had said in the early days. Mary Cadogan of the Krishnamurti Foundation in England had written, asking, when Krishnaji dies, what really happens to that extraordinary focus of understanding and energy that is K? What's going to happen when you die? Krishnaji had excellent mechanical skills, as I mentioned before, all his life, and particularly loved cars. And he used an automobile analogy to answer her. And this is what Krishnamurti said. This is on tape. They were tape recording it at his insistence. He said, I want this to be tape recorded so there's no confusion about this. And you can see from his emphatic way of speaking that he considered this a most important thing to convey. He said, and of course, another thing is, this was a man who was tremendously in pain. He had cancer of the pancreas and was under morphine, and so his language here is not as perfect as it would be otherwise. And so it's a little incoherent, but the message comes across. I was telling them this morning, for 70 years, that super energy, no, that immense energy, immense intelligence has been using this body. I don't think people realize what tremendous energy and intelligence went through this body. There's a 12-cylinder engine. A 12-cylinder engine. And for 70 years was a pretty long time, and now the body can't stand anymore. Nobody, unless the body has been prepared, very carefully protected, and so on. He spoke about the protection also throughout his life on many occasions. Nobody can understand what went through this body. Nobody. Don't anybody pretend. I mean, he continues insisting on this because he was surrounded by people who did not understand that. In fact, that's what I quote in the book, what happened later. Right after this, one of those persons was trying to contradict him and say, you better be careful what you're saying because people might misunderstand you. And he basically told the guy, shut up. You don't know what you're talking about. Let it go. This is the way it is. And so he said, I repeat, nobody amongst us or the public know what went on. I know they don't. And now after 70 years, it has come to an end. Not that that intelligence and energy, it is somewhat here every day and especially at night. And after 70 years, the body can't stand it, can't stand anymore. It can't. You won't find, and this is interesting also because it confirms something that CWL said. Interesting. You won't find another body like this or that supreme intelligence operating in a body for many hundred years. At that time, he was saying that there would be another teacher in about 500 years. And CWL had said something similar, that there would be another teacher in around 700 years was the figure CWL used. So give or take 100 years, that's what they were both talking about. And so he says, when he goes, it goes. There is no consciousness left behind of that consciousness, of that state. They'll all pretend or try to imagine they can get in touch with that. And Lord knows people will do that. isn't that the case? Perhaps they will somewhat if they live the teachings. But nobody has done it. Nobody. And so that's that. And so I think his relationship with the masters and his mission as a vehicle for the avataric manifestation is, to me, rather incontestable. and should no longer be a source of confusion to anyone except diehard true believers in whatever it is that they might want to be true believers of, people who refuse facts and refuse evidence. And so I was saying that one of the reasons why there has been so much confusion about all this is that Kay insisted on transformation. People want to be distracted. And the point is that any teaching, no matter what the teaching is, including the teaching of transformation, if you make that into an activity that you get involved in, that can become a distraction. Transformation is a discipline, tremendous discipline, that happens from day to day. But most people are deeply attached to their distractions. This way of understanding Krishnamurti's inner life has never been presented before. And everyone who has gone into this has said, oh, it's a mystery, or, oh, he was having hallucinations, he was deluded, he was having visions about all this. People who have written about his life in the past have said all of those things. And so what I am suggesting is something that has never been suggested before, in writing and in relying on evidence, not on belief. Not on belief because CWL said so or because I think so. But doing my best to search where the evidence went, and that's what I have done. That's what I have done in my book. Some people have said, for instance, that Kay denied the existence of the masters and that he denied his mission. We have already seen that that is not the case. What he denied was their fantasies. Another claim is that he denied the spiritual path. And what he actually denied was that following a method or following a system can possibly be a spiritual path. And see, one reason for this, other ways of looking at this, but one reason for this is that when you follow a certain set of procedures that you feel or that you believe because somebody told you, some book said it or whatever your reasons are, you think that by following a certain set of procedures, you are going to become enlightened or initiated or something good is going to happen in a deep sense of that word. What Kay is saying is that transformation consists of the act. The actual act is not an intellectual thing. It's the actual act of transcending all such mechanical processes, all such algorithms. So long as you are engaging in a practice that tells you, if you do A and B and C, boy, are you going to be happy when you get to D. You see, this is what spiritual disciplines in the past used to tell us. And so one of the things that I feel is involved here is that this is the perennial teachers, the masters, are turning a new leaf. They are presenting the ancient teaching in a new way, in a sense. Everything that Krishnamurti has said about this, you can find in some of the esoteric traditions throughout the world. The difference here, one of the important differences, as I see it, is that in the past, we used to have a lot of mythology, a lot of pretty stories, symbols, the use of symbols, the use of metaphysical systems, a lot of aids, educational aids, to help people to achieve this other or to come across this otherness, which is not of the world worldly. And we have seen how in some instances, those methods, those mythologies, those symbols, those metaphysical systems, have a place and they can help people up to a certain point. But we also see where very easily they become crutches that people get to use. And like, for instance, in Christianity, people get to believe the story of Jesus the way it's, you know, it's a neat little story, isn't it? But people get to believe in the story and it becomes an impediment to realizing the Christ in their hearts, which is what Christianity, I think, is really about. To, in other words, have this state of awareness, this compassion, this inside compassion in your daily life. This is what the real teaching of all the great religions is. And people get distracted. They get to love the story. They get wrapped up in the, many of them are pretty good stories, pretty darn good stories. And so it's understandable. And mythology is a very, very valuable thing. I'm not putting it down by any means. I have the greatest respect for Joseph Campbell, who began his work, by the way, in 1924 because of Krishnamurti. But I won't go into that now. I want to say something about the relevance of some of this to the history of the Theosophical Society. CWL and Annie Besant, as I mentioned before, had stated that the teaching that there would be an avatar in the 20th century and that there would be this new age, this new era, this new human type that would come about at this time, that this was not their own belief. This is not something that they created, that they invented, but that HPV and the masters had told them. And as I said before, that has been the source of so many divisions and so many confusions, because we have all assumed, including people who think the world of CWL and Annie Besant, that there isn't any such evidence. Well, I have been researching all these issues for many, many years, and I am not only interested in issues having to do with Krishnamurti, but I have also spent a great deal of time studying the secret doctrine, especially, but all of HPV's works and the letters of the masters and such. I have a great deal of interest in all that, and that's a story for another day, in a way. But I see the work of Blavatsky as being primarily psychological. That is, in the letters of the masters and in a number of places in her work, such as in The Esoteric Character of the Gospels, a great article that I highly recommend, she tells us that theosophy, in order to know what theosophy is, you must turn seven keys, or you must give seven turns to a key. She uses these expressions in different ways. And one of the keys that she mentions is the mythological. Mythological key can open the gates of the divine wisdom. The metaphysical key is another key. That too could open the gates to the to divine wisdom. But she says, the most critical key, the one that has to be opened first, is the psychological or mystical key. She uses different names for all this. That has to be turned first. Now, why is that? Because first there has to be initiation. There has to be transformation. If you are just a person off the street, so to say, you read the secret doctrine, you read the masters, you read the master's letters, you read all these works, and the process of transformation has not been going on in your life, the process of initiation hasn't been going on in your life, you're not psychologically prepared to know what this stuff is about. You're not prepared. And so I'll give you a reference. In letter number 63 of the Mahatma letters, the master K.H. addresses this very issue with A.P. Sinnett. A.P. Sinnett had been a prominent theosophist back in the 1980s, in the 1880s, 100 years earlier, in the 1880s, and he had written a book called The Occult World, which I'm sure they have in the bookstore here. Some of you may be aware of this book, may have read it. It's a very, by today's standards, a really simple little thing. It's a short book, very simple. It's talking strictly about psychic phenomena, how you can ring bells psychically, how HPV, basically, how she had these psychic powers, and how she could materialize a saucer, a cup and saucer, that was impossible, and so forth. These kinds of things are the things that Sinnott speaks about in the occult world. And these are the kinds of things that he was interested in, personally. He was very interested in all that psychic stuff. But he was one of those persons from off the street, no transformation here. And so in his book, he is doing his best to try to promote what he thinks is important in theosophy, all the psychic stuff. You know what the master tells him in that letter? The master tells him that in order to understand all these things that Sinnott was talking about, it is required to have three initiations. This is what the master says. And so what I am saying to you is that when you go into teachings such as reincarnation, karma, about the spiritual path, these are far more complex things than ringing of bells psychically. And if you need three initiations for understanding what's going on with ringing of bells, how many do you require to understand reincarnation, karma, the spiritual path? And so transformation is critical. We have to be serious in our lives before we get into the study of theosophy. The study of theosophy is not an intellectual thing. And so I want to end with this quote, because this, you have never heard this before. You should have, but you haven't. This has never been made public before. I'm going to give you a couple of quotes from the esoteric instructions. You can find this in the Secret Doctrine in the Adyar edition of 1971, which is the sixth volume edition, volume 5, pages 465 and 466. You can take this down if you want. I'll tell you later if you wish. And you can find this also in the Collected Writings of H.P. Blavatsky, volume 12, pages 600 to 602. This passage that I'm going to read to you now. And this of course, is the writings of the masters. It says, planetary spirits, the highest kumaras, those who incarnate no longer in the universe during this Mahamandantara, during this cycle, this grand cycle, appear on earth as avatars only at the beginning of every new human race, and at the junctions or close of the two ends of the small and great cycle. And so the masters are telling us that there is a grand cycle where there is an avatar manifestation. You can read this at your leisure later, but I'm just trying to simplify what I just read, because she uses a lot of there's a lot of language here that might be confusing. There will be an avatar manifestation at the beginning of every new race, and also at the junctions or close of the two ends of the small and the great cycle. Okay, so that's when you have an avatar. In the next paragraph, she tells us, she speaks about how the first Kali Yuga cycle would end in 1897. That Kali Yuga cycle began at the death of Krishna, slightly after midnight of February 17 of the year 3203. So 5,000 years later was the year 1897. And so she speaks about the end of the Kali Yuga cycle and a few years beyond, as the smaller dark cycle happens to overlap the great one. In other words, the masters are telling us here that such a cycle, such an avataric cycle, and therefore an avataric manifestation, was about to take place about that time. And in my researches, I have found other quotes that are even more astonishing than that. And again, that's a theme for another day. but quotes in which there are references to specific dates in the life of Krishnamurti.